impressed with it and very happy to have a chance to come and visit. Anyway, I'm going to give a talk about the strange metals. And I was going to use examples of high-temperature superconductors, heavy fermions, and charged density wave materials. It's too much, so I just decided I'll start by wiping those out and just concentrate on those two. Still too much stuff, but I hope you can bear with me. So the first thing I should do, I used to be at Argonne. I'm not there anymore, so it's just a distant memory there. Anyway, the first people I should thank are my collaborators, because they are the ones who do most of the work. And I just listen to them and learn something. So in particular, I want to highlight two people that have collaborated with me from the beginning, Mohit Randhiria from Ohio State and Mike Norman from Argonne. So they're theoreticians, and they helped me understand the experiments, the results, and trying to get more information out of the technique than was previously available. And they were able to make tremendous progress in the understanding of not just the technique, but the materials as well. So since we're going to talk about strange metals, I thought I'd start by just briefly talking about the paradigm for a normal metal. Electrons are interacting very strongly. We're concerned with electrons, low energy excitations of electrons, which gives us all the properties that we care about in metals, color, heat transport, electrical transport, all those things, transparency, et cetera, heat capacity. So that then Landau came along, and he formulated the theory of the Landau Fermi liquid, which said that even though electrons interact very strongly, say when an electron scatters off another one, it forms a electron hole pair. So an electron is basically dressed by all these excitations, and it carries with it a cloud of excitations, and that effectively just modifies the mass of the electron and the energy. It's modified by the self-energy, which is the thing that generates all the excitation, describes all the excitation. So the particles, free electrons, are not quite free. They're just dressed particles, which a fraction of them are long-lived. Still, like if they were independent electrons, they live a long time. So we can still sort of for most of physics use either perturbation theory or just consider them to be free electrons. So the momentum distribution, which would be quite spread out if the electrons were just strongly interacting just from exchange of energy and so on, in fact, still shows a discontinuity corresponding to the fraction of electrons that are long, of quasiparticles that are long-lived, and their weight is Z, the number of the fraction of them. So it's really a great advance in understanding normal metals, anyway. So we can still think of electrons as waves moving along with a modified mass and energy. But the most important thing that comes out of this is that the resistivity is proportional to the square of the temperature. And that's true for a Fermi liquid. And usually we think that if that's true, we have a Fermi liquid. And in fact, the strange metals that I'm going to talk about don't have a square resistivity dependence on temperature. So what do we mean by strange metals? We really mean things with different properties, but all their properties, most of the measured physical response functions are different. Everything is quite different. And I will try to tell you a little bit about it. So let's first look at the resistivity, and let's take a canonical metal, a very good conductor, which is, say, copper. So if we start with copper, I don't have a pointer, unfortunately. But anyway, does it show up there? Oh, no, I know what I can do, sorry. Sorry, you have? Huh? I can use what? Oh, there. It has two screens. So if we look at a standard metal, say a canonical metal, copper, you will see that at low temperatures, it has this pure metal, has a low residual resistivity. It's very pure, there's good conduction. And the resistivity is quadratic. And then at high temperatures, relatively high, when the electron has excited, has scattered all, it starts to scatter off the phonons, which are not there at very low temperatures, then the resistivity becomes linear. The difference is that in a strange metal, for example, a high temperature superconductor, there are two differences. It still has a compressible bunch of electrons, but you can change their density. You can dope them similar to a semiconductor, except that the resistivity in the normal state before it becomes a superconductor is always linear. It's never square, T-square dependence. So that's one of the strange characteristics, and there's been a lot of discussions in the field about that. Another example are the charge density wave materials. These are materials where the atoms rearrange themselves at below a certain temperature called a charge density wave transition, and they acquire new structures due to some interactions. People used to think it was nesting of the Fermi surface, but I don't think there are too many examples like that in reality, as I will show you. So the strange thing about these materials, is that, again, at high temperatures, what we would call the normal state, above this transition, that the resistivity is linear, but only below this charge density wave is quadratic, okay? This is an example that we've been studying lately. Well, mostly my former student, Utpal, has been doing a lot. So other properties, I won't go through all of them because it will get boring, but say susceptibility. This is interesting because if you look at a metal, the susceptibility tells you basically the number of spins, the density of spins or charge carriers in the metal, which is constant almost independent of temperature. But if you look at a high temperature superconductor, you see that as you lower the temperature well above this standard room temperature that we care about, you've already started to lose most of the spins, okay? They are disappearing, and that's very, very strange. And that was one of the first indications that something unusual was happening. Where are these things going to? I mean, you know, the number of electrons is really conserved, so they must be doing something unusual to give you this result. And also in the charge density wave material like this, this is data from Ong and Princeton, you see that in the high temperature it's constant more or less, but below this transition when the resistivity is linear, it just changes in a very strange way. So really it's not standard from the way we tend to think about materials. So we have been studying these with a technique called angle-resolved photoemission spectroscopy, which is, photoemission itself was first explained by Einstein as a proof of sort of quantum mechanics, the quantum nature of radiation. And so in this technique, we use photons in, and electrons come out, and we analyze their direction and their energy. And that tells us quite a bit, as I will hope to show you. The first thing we consider is that when the electron absorbs energy, it goes from an occupied state to an unoccupied state. If the energy of the unoccupied state is larger than the vacuum energy, it will come out and we measure them. And so, of course, Einstein first explained this, saying that the binding energy, the energy of that state inside the material, the metal, phi is a work function on top, so plus the work function, plus the kinetic energy of the measured electrons has to be equal to the photon energy. So this is a conservation rule which is helpful in trying to measure one of the quantum numbers of the electron, the energy. We can also measure the spin and many other things as I will show you later on. And the other thing we can do is It's been noticed that the momentum, the other thing we care about, in outside is just a free electron, so it's just that value. And if we project it onto the surface, it gives you the momentum parallel of the electron before it was photoemitted. If the perpendicular component, there's a broken symmetry, so it doesn't conserve, but the parallel momentum does. And that's extremely useful, particularly since we're looking at two-dimensional materials. But never mind, we can use the technique in three-dimensional materials as well. So what can we learn from the ARPA spectra? So let's take electrons out, say, near normal emission. And what we have here is a plot of the number of electrons as a function of, where happened to my pointer? A number of electrons as a function of, here's the number, as a function of energy, right? And you can see a certain distribution. Zero is the level of the work function. So electrons that are bound in the solid exist below this zero. If there wasn't this work function, they all just spill out into vacuum and we wouldn't have materials. So they're bound in by the work function, basically, or the inner potential, depends how you'd like to describe them. And then there's a peak here describing there's a particular state which is making a transition. And as we change the angle, we change the momentum of the electron, you can see that this state is dispersing, is changing its energy with momentum. Each value corresponds to a value of momentum. And it's changing shape and intensity and so on. That's because there are a lot of interesting many body effects going on there, which I will tell you about some more. So once you reach the Fermi energy, which is that that red curve, after that you don't see much because those states are empty. So each spectrum corresponds to a particular value of momentum and the position of the peak to the energy. So you can derive the standard thing you might find in textbooks, the position and energy plot, which is like a band structure calculation, does, and it tells you what it is. And for more information you can get is the width of this material, of this state, you see it's changing with energy, and it's 1/ the lifetime, proportional to, from the uncertainty principle. So we learn quite a bit about the electron. And furthermore, the slope of this curve, of the dispersion, is the group velocity of this proportional, it's the group velocity of the electrons. So we can determine what they are. In this material, for example, you can measure it, and it's 3 × 10⁸ centimeters second, which is very close to that of, say, copper. A little bit smaller, but not much. And I will tell you in a minute why that's significant. So this is an experiment. You can see it looks just like that because nowadays we measure the whole thing in one shot. And so why has ARPES contributed to our understanding or to this problem in particular? And there are several reasons. First, because these materials have very strong momentum dependence and most techniques are not momentum sensitive, NMR and so on. Optical, you can have general ideas, but they don't have strict selection rules. Photoemission does. And the high temperatures involved here for the superconducting transition and other effects means that we have enough resolution to be able to get some information out of these techniques. So we can see things that before were not easy to see, like the gap and so on. And it also has high energy resolution, and we can look at a lot of elementary excitations as well. So what our theoretician friends and collaborators helped us do is to take this technique well beyond the just mapping those bands, which is what people did until recently. And it started by developing some rules. There are just only approximate sum rules, but they're pretty close for angle resolve photoemission. The first one is that if you integrate the spectrum over all energies, you get the momentum distribution, okay? So that's very important because we can independently measure the momentum distribution. But there's an interesting corollary here that if there is a particle hole symmetry, at least in a small energy range, then this quantity, N of k, is constant at the Fermi at the Fermi momentum. So the Fermi density of momentum states is a constant. And that's very useful with temperature. So at least if this condition is satisfied, then we can show that's true. And we can check it experimentally. So here, for example, is data from a high-temperature superconductor as a function of temperature. And you can see the spectrum is changing dramatically with temperature. Many things are happening. All the interactions are very strongly temperature-dependent and momentum-dependent. And so using this selection rule, we see that if we integrate each of those spectra and we do, in fact, get a constant, which is right here. So we know that this sum rule is approximately satisfied. And we know that then we can make a conclusion that can come out of it is that there's an impulse approximation. That means when the electron absorbs a photon and it comes out, it leaves behind a hole, a positive charged region. And there's an interaction, of course, between the electron, Coulomb, between the electron and the charge left behind the hole. And if the electron doesn't get away fast enough, then the interaction with this hole messes up the conservation rules that I described before. So normally people thought they had to use very high energy photons to get this thing to work. But it turns out that at the energies that we're using, photon energies we're using, which are more easily accessible, the process works as well, and you can always check it just to be sure. So that means that a corollary of that is that the signal is proportional to Fermi's golden rule for, say, that the green part, which is for independent particles, say, to take a particle from initial state to a final state via the dipole operator. But since they're strongly interacting, there's a self-energy, there's a spectral function A of k omega, and it's multiplied by the Fermi function because we're measuring fermions. Okay, but it also means that if we divide the signal by the Fermi function, we can obtain A of k and omega. So we can measure directly A of k and omega, which is an imaginary part of the Green's function, the retarded part of the Green's function. So that means that we can directly compare to modern theories which calculate this quantity. And that's very useful. Okay, so let's look at some of the common properties between these strange metals, which are different from a standard metal. Let's look at the photoemission from a high temperature superconductor somewhere. It's indicated there. I will explain more what that phase diagram is. But the first thing you see, even though the temperature here is only like 100 Kelvin or so, or 150 Kelvin, is that you have, at the Fermi energy, a very wide peak in energy. The peak is very wide in energy. And this is not what Fermi liquid theory says. Fermi liquid theory says the energy, the width of the energy should be proportional to 1 over t squared. So obviously, this is not a Fermi liquid. Okay, there are no quasi-particles. These peaks correspond to some complex interaction that we don't know anything about. So that was the first, that's why these things were called strange metals, because they really don't look like our paradigms in usual condensed matter physics, or the paradigms used until then. Okay, so now we know that this is the spectral function times the Fermi function. So we measure the Fermi function. And so we know we can divide it out. So this is the peak that you would get by dividing out the Fermi function. And you see, you only see part of it, half of it. So that means that this thing is incredibly broad. And so just using the uncertainty principle and so on, and the measurement of the velocity, you can calculate that the time that this electron lives is very, very short. It's four of the order of 4 times 10 to the minus 15 seconds, 4 femtoseconds. And that's really, really very short, because the electron doesn't travel very far. We know what the velocity is. We've measured it. And so we know that it travels a few unit cells, I mean, very little distance. So, and then it scatters, and then it disappears from the spectrum. So that means that even though they're traveling very fast, almost as fast as in a regular metal, they're not living for very long. So there aren't any quasi-particles, things that have long lifetimes, like we are used to thinking about it. So we can't use the standard tools that we use, like the in solids, in periodic solids, we use the Bloch functions. And all the things that you see calculated in books, the textbooks are based on and that. So we have to, something new has to come along. However, when we lower the temperature into the superconducting state, all of a sudden this peak gets very sharp, and we now have a Fermi liquid. Okay, so at first most people didn't believe this or understand it or so on, but some people did, fortunately, and they told us that we were not completely off the wrong path, on the wrong path. Okay, so I'm going to show you just a little trick. This is only for didactic purposes. So if we take the spectral function, this red thing here, and we just reflect it about zero, we get this blue thing. All right? And then, so that's this spectrum. Omega goes to minus omega. And then if we sum that, f of minus omega is 1 minus f of omega. So if you sum those two, you just get directly a of k of an omega. Now this only, what did I do here? This only works, of course, within the range where you have particle-hole symmetry, where A of k omega is equal to A of minus k minus omega, A of k minus omega. But we know, I will show you later, that we have particle-hole symmetry within this region here. Okay, here, no. So you can't trust this thing at very high energies. But at low energies, it gives you a picture of what's going on, although we carefully make sure that that is correct. All right, so what about charge-sensitive waves? Here is a charge-sensitive wave that we've studied recently. It's niobium diselenide, and again, it's a hexagonal structure, but when you, and here are the diffraction peaks for that structure. This is from scanning tunneling microscope. And once you go below the transition temperature, new peaks appear here, were first described by using Pyrrell's theory of nesting of the Fermi surface, and so they're called charge density waves. Here's the Fermi surface of that material, and we really do not see much evidence of nesting at all. There isn't anything here which is very parallel. To nest, to get to sufficient total energy to go into the nesting, they have to be parallel to each other. But there is not much of that going on here. There is a gap, but it's not very large, and certainly is far more than nesting that is needed to describe such a process. And here are some of the properties of this material. Oops, what happened to my, there. Okay, so you can see that it's just like the high TCs in some detail. Here's the CDW transition. It's over by 33 Kelvin or something. This is the X-ray diffraction, so you can see that it goes from long-range order above TC at 35 Kelvin. You lose the long-range order. This peak has to be multiplied by a factor of 30 to see it. And you see it's much broader. It has a different response. It's a Lorentzian, not a sort of sharp peak resolution-limited Gaussian. So we know that this system still has short-range order above TC. It doesn't have long-range order. It no longer has long-range order. The weird thing is that this short-range order, this fluctuating state, persists until very high temperature, up to room temperature, as far as we measured it. It's still there, as seen by X-rays. And if we look at the photo emission, you can see that you don't have quasi particles here in the above the charge density wave transition, just like in the high TCs. Oops, only below the charge density wave, when you have a square dependence of the resistivity, do you have quasi particles. Sorry. I'm not so sure I know. I don't think I know the answer. Because we only measured the correlation length with STM, and it's not like Davis's STM. It's only a small area, and so. What? It doesn't seem to have an awful lot until you get to TC, and then you just very quickly lose it. Well, there's a transition up there according to X-ray diffraction. It's fairly sharp. Okay. So the second common feature, so the first one was that these materials have no quasi-particles in their sort of normal state, which we mean by, you know, the range of room temperature and so on, not too cold. The second feature is something called the pseudogap. And here's a nominal phase diagram that is used by many people to describe these things. And this applies to a lot of materials. Here's just the high TC one. But what I want to emphasize is I want to get my magnifying glass and look at this pseudogap phase. What is it? So let me show you. So here's a phase diagram. Now I'm looking on the other side of the phase diagram. So before I showed you data here, somewhere here, now I'm looking here at higher temperatures. And you see that the spectrum is it's also very strange. It's very broad. This is a much bigger energy range. So it has a very strange feature. It's also a Lorentzian. And I will show you later, it's really, really strange, part of this strange metal thing. And as we lower the temperature, all of a sudden, there's a hole that develops in the spectral function. Some electrons are missing. Some spins are missing. So now you connect this to the susceptibility results that at rather high temperatures, the spins are gone. The excitations are gone. Where did they go? That is the big question. I'm not so sure we still know the answer of where they've gone. It's, of course, the electrons are conserved, so something has happened to them. And that is a big argument in the field. If we go, so we measure as a function of doping, and it has this dependence with doping. Okay, and distinct from the one that people usually use for describing the phase diagram. And once you go into the superconducting state, you get the typical superconductor spectral function. That means you get the two peaks, which come from the pairing of electrons, the particle-hole pair, and so on and so forth. But that is over a small energy range. Over the larger energy range, it's just nothing much has changed. Okay, so this is what we call a pseudogap. And so the question is, where are these electrons going? When we first looked at it, we thought, okay, this gap here that appeared at high temperatures is the same as the superconducting gap, other than details of the line shapes. So we thought it had to do with some pairing. The material was getting ready to become a superconductor by pairing some of the electrons, but there's no long-range order. But this has been severely disputed. I am, however, pleased to see that this is a more recent experiment from the UBC people. And they have collected all the data available in the pseudogap energy or crossover temperature using every available experiment and sample. The list is there. And you can see that it's just exactly the same as the line that we plotted way back. Okay, so it really is fairly robust. Okay, so the question is there a pseudo gap in the CDW, in the charge density wave system? And yes, there's a whopping big one right there. Okay, so a lot of states have disappeared in a very similar manner. Okay, there are no quasi-particles, there's just a big gap and so on. Okay, so there's another similarity between those two. Now, this pseudo gap is far more interesting in that, sorry? The zero is the Fermi energy, yes. Yes, it's a little bit of, well, there's no particle hole symmetry in this case for sure. If you go to finite temperatures, you can do that up to a certain point. You divide by the Fermi function. Eventually, the data get very noisy, so you see that we have to cut it off at this energy here because at this temperature, we can't go more than 4 kBT roughly above the Fermi energy, but we can do that up to that energy, divide by the Fermi function. Then the Fermi function is too small, and we just get meaningless results. But you can do this for a little bit. Okay. The interesting thing about this pseudo gap is that it eats up only part of the states the Fermi surface of this material is like a cylinder, okay? And we have states here, everywhere here. Okay, I didn't plot them all, but they're just missing in this region. And of course, similarly in this region and so on around the Fermi surface. So that's the pseudo gap at high temperatures, just below the pseudo gap crossover region. And as you lower the temperature, something very weird happens. This arc that's left over is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, okay? So something is happening as a function of temperature. It's hard to think of many gaps that, physical models of gaps that would do this, really, that are so temperature dependent. Certainly, regular band couplings are not like this, they're temperature independent and so on. So this is rather an unusual thing. Okay, so now we have filled up part of our phase diagram, and we see that if we reduce the doping even more, we should get to just point on the Fermi surface, and the question is, what does that mean? A thing that has just four points on the Fermi surface. And people proposed, Matthew Fisher and his collaborators, I guess he spent some time here, proposed that's a thing called a nodal metal. And so we found there's a scaling of the size of this arc with the temperature of the pseudo gap. And in fact, it does go to zero at some very low doping. And we have since published a paper showing that there's such a thing as a nodal metal. It's a very, really unusual, to say the least. Okay, but this is a very low doping. The material is no longer superconducting. So here's a third common feature of these two materials, a phase diagram. So there's a phase diagram of a CDW. It's rather similar to this, the high TCs. It doesn't say pseudo gap up here, it says semi-metal, but I showed you there's a big pseudo gap, there's linear dependence of the resistivity, so, you know, what is it like? So let me start by describing a bit more the spectral function of the strange metal. So the near 300 Kelvin, high temperature, I can take data there, well above the TC, and we can see this weird peak. It's weird because it doesn't have any features in it. It has no energy dependence. It has no temperature dependence, and it has no doping dependence. It's just a Lorentzian. Where did it come from? We have no idea, but there it is. And however, so there's a region here, I will show you more later, where this behavior occurs. Okay, so, what? Here to show, yes, but you don't need to do the, to determine this, because the energy scales here are very large. The temperature is very high, so you can just divide by a Fermi function if you wish. We tried everything. It's in our paper. I don't want to take up all the time. What? Only up to a point above the peak, a very small region above the peak. Not much, okay? But the shape of the thing is fairly constant. That's for sure. Because at larger energies, it stays that way even in the superconductor. Once you get above 3 times a gap or so, it just keeps that shape. It's pretty characteristic. Okay, so let's look at a different part of the phase diagram. What happens down here, say down here? So we'll do some experiments. So we start in this pseudo gap, this spectra that I showed you before. And I told you it's temperature independent. As we lower the temperature, it just sits there. It doesn't do much. It doesn't depend on temperature or energy or doping. If I take the data here, it will still be the same. Or way up here, say, it'll still be the same. Okay? What? Well, there's no temperature dependence from here to here. Okay, so if I go below that point, I have a quasi-particle peak. I'm in sort of like a Fermi liquid state. And you can clearly distinguish the two. Okay? And as you keep going down, this quasi-particle residue gets bigger and bigger and bigger, of course, as you would expect. Okay? So here we have a more normal Fermi liquid-like excitations, and everything is well, all is well, right? So what happens at 100K? That's when things really get interesting. So if I look at this point, which is a pseudo gap, I see this lost spectral weight there, the pseudo gap, and as I increase the doping, the pseudo gap gets smaller because it scales with doping, and so on. But the amazing thing is that all of a sudden, something weird happens, okay? We have both a pseudo gap and quasi-particle peaks, sharp peaks. What's going on? This, in fact, it took us until very recently to understand what this was. And this behavior stays for a little while. You can see there. And only once you go far enough away do you get the Fermi liquid. But here's what I was telling you, that the shape here above a certain energy is all the same, the energy dependence of this shape. So only at smaller energies, remember this is a big energy range, 400 millivolts, so only at small energies is where all the action is. And then you just have more and more quasi-particles and so on. Things are looking more normal. We didn't understand what this was, so my students called it the Bermuda Triangle. Okay, this triangle here. We had no other name for it. So, and as Isidore Pauli, rabbi would have said, who ordered that? Well, somebody did. And that was this paper who preceded most of the stuff in high TC. It was just shortly after, 2-3 months or so after the discovery, when we didn't know anything about them, very little about the structure. We didn't know what was important or what wasn't, and so on. And Anderson came along and said, yeah, this is a strange material. And he wrote a wave function there. Most people thought he had lost his marbles. And of course he hadn't. He's just very intuitive and thought about it and worked in oxides for a long time, so he had a good idea. And almost at the same time, there was this paper by Bhaskaran, Su, and Anderson, which figured out what the mean field theory was for this state. And using that mean field theory, Cotlier at Rutgers, Gabi Cotlier and Susumura, working with Fukuyama in Japan, calculated this phase diagram. And the reason then at this point we had to think about this, until then I just preferred to stay away from theory really because, but here let me just show you this because it's startling. It really is. So here's the experimental phase diagram. And there's an incredible similarity between them, more than meets the eye, because the nature of these two lines is only described in this theory. There's that line and that line. In one of them, this strange metal, the spin-ons, the spins are sort of condensing, and in the other, along the other, the boson, the charged part is condensing. And so you have this peculiar phase diagram. Okay, and the nature of the two is different, and they cross like this. And again, it's only in this case where they would do that, as far as we know. So it wasn't until 2011 that we understood this, where what is this relationship to everything else. And I'm going to do something that my colleagues tell me never to do, because this calculation is, you would agree with me, it's very crude. It doesn't consider fluctuations. It doesn't consider magnetism, and so on and so forth, okay? And there are many other states that Subir told us about yesterday that are not in here. It's just a very simple argument based on this empirical, on this ansatz of Anderson. And it's really rather suggestive. I found this absolutely fascinating. But anyway, it does seem to fit that. The only reason why then DC is suppressed here, it has both the characteristics of this line and that line, but it's suppressed because of fluctuations, obviously. And fluctuations can be seen here readily in the superconductor. So I'm just about finished. There's still no accepted theory. Most people don't, they didn't understand this then, they still don't know. And I must admit that it's very hard because it's a 2+1 dimensional theory, and we're not integrable, and we don't know what the ground state is, and we know very little about it. It has been improved upon, well, not improved. Paramikanti, who's in Toronto, and Mohit Randeria and Nandini Trivedi published a variational wave function study of this Anderson wave function. They added something else to it, some unitary transformation to it, to account for the number of doping dependence of the carrier density. And it remarkably reproduces most of the experimentally measured quantities. So it's really quite suggestive, okay? It's not really a proof, it's just a suggestion. So the field, it's a mess still. Of course, if you ask an artist like Gerald Saldan, who's a Canadian, draw this diagram where all these weird states and theories coexist peacefully. You have checkerboard order, you have d-density waves, you have stripes, you have skirmions, everything under the sun is living happily with everything else. Of course, if you ask a physicist, they will not think that there's any peaceful coexistence. In fact, the field is sort of in a danger of becoming, it's out of order. It's becoming almost a religion, This is terrible. I'm sorry, I messed up. Does it? Yes, it does, doesn't it? I never realized that. You're absolutely right. It does look like a superconducting dome. Okay, so let me not go too fast here. This is out of order, I'm sorry. Oh, this is just a joke, so it doesn't really very much matter. But, it's almost like a religious war. I mean, some people have some dogmas, other people have other dogmas, and they shan't be happy until they, I don't know, do what. But thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, so we have plenty of time for questions. So who would like to start off?
you contrasted cuprates with niobium diselenide.
Say that again, please. I'm sorry.
You contrasted cuprate with niobium diselenide.
Yes.
And you showed pseudo gap and many other things. Are you also implying that electron correlations are very important there? Because the original picture was electron phonon coupling and nesting. And you indicated several times that in the normal state, there is no obvious nesting.
There's almost, I think there might be one compound, the original one, where people can see this gap due to nesting, but most materials don't show this. The gap might be above the Fermi energy. That's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. But there's no obvious change in this Fermi surface with temperature above and below the...
I see.
So people proposed all kinds of other mechanisms like susceptibility peaks and all sorts of things. I'm not really all that familiar with it. But it's hard to describe this with the original nesting theory.
Picture. Okay. Sam, I did not know about this data because it's very... There is a small group of people who believe that niobium diselenide is a strongly correlated system.
Oh, it is. So it has all the properties.
Not
it
is the strange. Simple Fermi surface and nesting phenomena.
Yeah. So most people would say, you know, you're crazy or something like that. But, you know, the data is like that. The correlations, these short-range order, persist up to where we've been able to measure at room temperature. Okay, it's just amazing. It's similar to the pseudo gap in the high TCs. It's up to very high temperatures. There are no quasi-particles, and I can just show you the similarities. I don't know what it means.
Okay. And the original plan was to tell something about heavy fermions.
Yeah, heavy fermions have many other characteristics. They don't have quasi-particles at high temperatures. The phase diagram is very similar. But there are other complicated effects that would require time. Is that at very high temperatures, the spin and the charge are acting very separately. Again, similar to other materials. There are different sectors of the energy space, and it's only after below a certain temperature where they form F electrons. And after the F electrons form and they scatter the conduction electrons, only at very low temperatures do they form a coherent state. So a lot of things happen in between, but it would take me too long to, I can tell you later, but it would take too long to describe now. But it's a very complex physics going on. And again, it's one of those systems where, other than Anderson's model, which is just a model, there's no explanation for this behavior.
So, last short question. So, if I look at your experiment and results, in terms of well-developed quasi-particles, you see them only in the superconducting state.
In this material, yes.
In this material, in the nodal quasi-particles.
Not when you overdope them to the point where they're way overdoped. Yeah, then we can see quasi-particles also.
And do the nodal quasi-particles have some anomalous behavior, or they are Fermi liquid-like?
At what?
Do the nodal quasi-particles, what is the scaling of their width? Is it Fermi liquid-like, or there are corrections to experimentally?
You know what? We haven't had enough resolution to answer that question, and I'm not so sure anybody has thought about it. There are all kinds of claims out there, but they're contradictory from the same technique and so on. A lot of it you can attribute to, you know, it really requires some very careful, high resolution experiments beyond what we can do so far.
Thank you.
What we can do, I'm not saying other people cannot do.
There are two ways to plot this overdoped crossover regime of the Fermi liquid. One is that extrapolate to a quantum critical point, like 0.19. For this crossover of Fermi liquid. Your plot actually seems like consistent with the RVB, original RVB theory. It goes to the low doping coincide with superconducting phase transition. So I was wondering, so the presumably this comes from the ARPA's measurement. How accurate you can tell?
Well, it's not just ARPA's. I showed you this paper from UBC where they take almost every technique there is and every sample there is. So it's not just ARPA's. You know, it was first discovered in NMR. It's the same thing. In almost any technique which might be bulk sensitive or
overdoped.
Yeah, the overdoped region. So the question is, what happens? The question was basically to do with, if you look at this phase diagram here, okay, wait, what I'm going to do is move this here so we can talk about it. Oh, sorry. But the question was up here, why does this line come down here when many people draw it down to here, which is where there's supposed to be a quantum critical point? Well, I think there is a quantum critical point because if you look at the superconductor below this number here, it has a very different behavior. It's really not BCS-like, okay, compared to this superconductor, which is BCS-like. For example, below here, well, here, it's like BCS at high temperatures has quasi-particles, and you pair them, and you understand. Here, there's no such thing, okay? So what's happening? We don't know, but also, if I try to kill superconductivity, which we have tried, then on this side, it's easy to do, okay? And there's two parts to the order parameter. There's a phase, and there's an amplitude. And you can kill the phase very easily, not the amplitude. And that's basically a pseudo gap. But on this side, on the other side, you kill both at the same time. It's more BCS-like. But why is a pseudo gap like this? I don't know the answer. Okay.
Actually, my question was about this T coherent.
The what?
T coherent. You know, overdoped the crossover from normal metal to strange metal.
Yeah.
And this consistent with the left panel, this RVP theory. But there's another plot is that actually it's the lower temperature. It extrapolates to the critical point. So there's a...
Well, I showed you the data. I cannot...
So I was wondering if this comes from the ARPA's or...
Yeah, from our measurements. I didn't plot that line from anything else. Yes, just our measurements. Sorry.
Is there another question?
So for this pseudo gap region, there are like evidence for pockets or it's a large Fermi surface?
Are there pockets or not? Again, there's no agreement on that. I don't know the answer to that really. I mean, we don't seem to see them. Maybe we didn't look carefully enough. But some people claim they see it, so I'll just tell you that. I don't know the answer really yet. Could go either way.
Thanks.
I don't know.
Are there any further questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you very much.